from the Skinny D Media Archives.
Three, two, one.
Good evening, everyone. This is Skinny E Media, otherwise known as Mark. I just done an interview that was in French some weeks ago, but I'll be doing it in English for everyone. Here we have MJ Bassett, one of the great British filmmakers that you may or may not heard of.
That's not true. One of the great... I'm a British filmmaker. I don't know. Great. There's a lot more. Me, but go, keep going, and you might do some nice things.
Most people will probably know her for making Silent Hill Revelation, but I also know her particularly for Death Watch and Wilderness. And she's done a lot of TV projects, working with the likes of Bruce Campbell and Wesley Snipes, like Ash versus Evil Dead and The Player. Now she's working on the new Jack Reacher program, I believe, for Prime Video. So,
yep,
well, good to have you on board.
Thank you for inviting me.
Hey, you're definitely welcome. Always nice to have famous people, even if you say otherwise.
Well, it's a relative term, isn't it? You know, fame is a nebulous, non-specific, and not very relevant thing. But you know, in this modern world, who knows?
Well, to each their own, I suppose.
Yeah. So
I guess let's get cracking with the questions for time purposes. I know Wilderness, particularly, is my favorite film of
right
work. I know we'll be having like its 15th, 16th year anniversary of sorts.
2006, was it maybe, I think?
Yeah, it came out in cinemas and then it disappeared. Momentum Pictures 15 certificate. I remember like it was yesterday.
That's crazy.
Make thrillers or horrors like that like they used to anymore, except for like Sense of Prana Bailey Bond and then Hush by Mark Tondelier. But that's two other filmmakers that I've talked to that. That's another step, but let's talk about the genesis behind Wilderness. How did it come about?
Right, okay. Well, it's 15 years ago, so the specifics might be a bit vague, but it grew out of the... So I'd made my first movie, Death Watch, which had taken forever to get made, took forever to become a filmmaker in the UK, because genre movies, when I was coming of age, were not really a thing out of England. It was just kind of the social awareness and those movies, you know, Mike Lee... and
Loach.
Those kinds of and Ken Loach, those guys, they're making socially aware movies which are political. I grew up on the video age where it was all genre stuff. So I grew up on American horror movies. I used to cut school and rent a load of VHS videos with my buddies, and we just watched movies all day long. A lot of these were video nasties as well, like I Spit on Your Grave and Evil Dead, Last House on the Left, Texas Chainsaw. So all those movies which we weren't supposed to be watching. But obviously they had a huge impact on me. So when I became a filmmaker, let's make a horror movie first. So I made Death Watch, which was moderately successful, moderately well-liked. It was just enough to keep me in the business. But it wasn't like, one of my contemporaries is Neil Marshall, and Neil went on to, made Dog Soldiers, which everybody loved. And then he made The Descent, which is a classic. And so Neil, we were friends. He used to come and stay occasionally. Like we'd talk and it'd be like, God damn, he's got the career I want. And I was just figuring out what I'm going to do. So what nobody tells you when, certainly maybe be different now, but when I was starting, is that the first movie is not the hardest movie you're going to make. The second movie is the hardest movie you're going to make. Because if your first movie wasn't a giant success, then you're just another person trying to make a movie next. When you haven't made a movie, because this industry is entirely predicated on the notion of some kind of magic dust, right? So if you haven't made a movie, the promise that you might make a great movie is still there. If you've made a movie which is just okay, they know that you can make a movie, but it was just okay. So suddenly you're not, it's much harder to get the second movie off the ground. So I had a bunch of offers, which were not real, you feel like, okay, I'll do this. I was trying to write my own stuff, couldn't get it sold. I had... The UK industry at the time was basically built on like tax dodges and tax credits. So
UK every council and operating with EU partners.
Right. All of that stuff. But back in we're talking about the 90s now, late 90s, I guess, where there were certain tax there were, and there were slippery little tax dodges. So rich people were putting money into these tax credits and you could get your movie funded with that money. So I was like, okay, I've got a film made. I've written a thing. It was ready to go. I literally had my bags packed. I mean, that's not a joke. Everyone says literally. No, I had my bags packed. I had my passport checked. I was ready to go to the airport. And we call it Black Wednesday. The UK government changed all the tax rules and closed the tax loopholes that allowed these films to be made. So my movie collapsed and I was back to being unemployed again. And I never made commercials. I never had any other way of making a living. It was like writing stuff or directing stuff. That was my plan. I had a family as well. I was, you know, so I was looking around and Wilderness came across my desk, right? So Wilderness was a company called Ecos Films, which is mostly a UK TV production company. And they made some, you know, Saturday, you know, or sort of tea time dramas, which are very popular, but never dipped into this. I was sent Wilderness. It was a script by Dario Marinelli. And it was a, you know, it was a slasher movie. And there was lots of it I liked. And I wanted to make it a bit grittier, a bit harder, a bit more realistic, a little bit more like, I think there was a UK show called Scum, which did Ken Loach direct that? I can't remember. Well, anyway, it
Alan
was
Clark.
Alan Clark. Thank you very much.
That's yeah. a really so disturbing Alan, film.
Alan Clark, who directed Scum, I think it was Ray Winston's first movie as well. I thought, like, can I do a Scum meets slasher movie kind of vibe? And that's what I wanted. I wanted to make something that was pretty grim, because that was my sensibility back then. Rewrote the script. Dario wasn't really involved in it beyond that first draft. We financed it, and it was very low budget, and went to Northern Ireland to shoot it, put together a little cast of young actors. We knew we needed a couple of names. So Sean Pertree, who was the go-to horror guy for a whole generation of English filmmakers. I think Sean's been like killed. He's like Sean Bean. He's like, he's been killed a million times. We put Sean, Alex Reed, who'd been in Descent for Neil, who was a female lead. And then Toby Kebbell, who was the sort of essentially male lead, had just done a movie called Dead Man's Shoes for Shane Meadows.
That's and a great film.
It's a fantastic movie. Fantastic movie. So Toby had played the mentally handicapped younger brother. So there was no evidence that he could play this bad motherfucker. Can I swear on this?
We don't censor.
Okay, good. Okay. This bad guy, you know, this bad motherfucker who was tough and was ultimately going to be the hero or the anti-hero. But he, in real life, Toby comes from a rough background and he's pretty tough and he was just so good. So we got him on board and then put together this ensemble. And I really like doing ensemble movies. So that's how it came about. And then everything else about it was just like standard, you know, shooting in Ireland production issues.
I think that's the most charming part about the film was how it actually got made and the sort of genre conventions and specifics that were going along with it. Looking at it in a modern perspective, many will say, oh, that sounds a little bit like Hunger Games. And I tell them, no, it's even better than that. I'm sure the interest has been renewed for the film, particularly because of stuff like Hunger Games or Squid Game or Purge, which rely on young people killing one another. It's all tit for tat race of things. I don't know.
I mean, maybe that's true. I don't know, because the thing is, it was anti-glossy as well, right? So we shot it on 16mm, and rather than my first movie, I shot on Super 35mm. It's working with film. This one, the budget was very low, but it felt like Super 16, and this was before digital cameras were really working properly. Super 16 felt like a good way of going. It was, I think Peter Robertson was the DP. Who I met years later. I went to shoot a TV show. What the hell did I didn't think on Night Flyers, which was a sci-fi thing based on a George R.R. Martin short story. This was for, you know, was it for Netflix maybe? A couple of years ago. And Peter was my DP again. And my first AD was the same first AD because we shot it in Ireland. So suddenly it's like, oh my God, all this time has passed. You know, lots happened to me, lots happened to them, but you go back to these places. So the industry is really tiny as well. You know, like, okay, everybody keeps circulating. But yeah, for Wilderness, again, it was the second movie, so I wasn't super experienced. So it was just like, let's go into the woods and shoot some shit, right? And that's kind of what we did. You know, the dogs were interesting because it was, okay, let's make the pack of dogs the bad, you know, like the one of the tools of the enemy. And when I was young, I'd worked with the police to help train police dogs. Help train. I was the victim of police dogs. So what I used to do is I used to run for them. You know, you put the big leather pad on your arm and then you run away and they let the dogs chase you. And I used to run into woods, hide, and the dogs would track me down. And then when the dogs were coming for you, they'd say, basically, put your arm in the air and make sure they bite your arm, because they'll bite any bit of you. I thought, great, let's do that, because that'll be fun. Because the problem is that dogs that are trained to attack you can't be used on film set, because they're proper attack dogs. And properly trained dogs don't want to do it. So you had to find that balance between, you know, how we did the assaults. And I remember there's one scene, I think it's when Sean Pertwee's killed, where I really wanted the camera to be kind of his point of view. And so the first time I actually used a digital camera for anything, we used a digital camera with a little tiny lens adaptation that you could hold. And it's like the camera operator went, well, I'm not going to be attacked by the dogs. I'm not doing that. And the stunt person was like, I can't operate a camera. So I'm like, all right, I'll do it. So I put on all the leather pads, held the camera, and the dogs attacked me. So the person at the other end of the the person at the end of that dog attack is actually me, getting shaken like a rag doll. I mean, crazy, crazy, crazy. So yeah, fun times.
Very intense experience. I've never been.
They're very strong. When you have like
an animal,
three of them. I mean, and it's actually not even that well shot, to be honest. But I remember the experience very clearly.
Well, I mean, from the cinematography that was shown, whether it be the wolf attacks or attacks of place, human on human, so brutal and gritty. I'm sure, yeah. You know, because I remember it was a 15 certificate, and I think to myself, wow, that was really violent. Like,
it's the intent, fuzz, right?
It was 15, it's but that was gruesome.
Yeah, it's the intent, right? So what I wanted to do, and with respect to Dario, I actually can't remember what his original script did in terms of my rewrite. So, you know, I could be doing him a disservice here, but I remember what I wanted to make sure was that the kids killed each other as much as the bad guy did it, right? Because it was about the violence within the group. And it's sort of Lord of the Flies vibe as well. And Stephen White, who plays the skinhead, intense sort of neo-Nazi young man, he's actually the loveliest, gentlest human being, but my God, he could play that cruelty and that brutality very, very well. He actually plays kind of ineffective. I see him pop up on screen every so often, and he's playing nerdy dudes. I'm like, how the hell do you play nerdy dudes? I know him to be this super scary, intense young man, but you know, what are you going to do? Same with Adam Deacon. He's like, so Adam, who went on after Wilderness to win the BAFTA Rising Star Award for some of his work on
Inuverhood and Payback Season, and I think he was in some Shank revolving entertainment type of hood films.
He was literally like Inuverhood and Kidulthood and all those kinds of movies, and I think he directed one of them as well. But I remember Adam turning up and being, again, just super cool, funny, capable, and it was a good ensemble. They were good, fun people. You know, and it was nice. It was nice. I was still finding my feet as a filmmaker, trying to figure out what I was doing. And it was a good experience. Yeah. Summer in Northern Ireland.
Hey, very impressive there. I wish I could meet Stephen White myself, because his role kind of reminded me of that bold bloke. I think Dexter Fletcher or someone played him on This Is England. Just the sort of younger
film. Was that Tim Roth?
I think Tim Roth was in Made in Britain, but similar role of a, you know.
Oh, This Is England. That was Shane's other thing, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and there's, you know, similarities and threads here and there, and the scam connection, like you said earlier on, I definitely got that instantly on the first thing. I knew mates at a one school. One of them went to prison, oddly enough, for I won't say what offence, but I'm sure he's not having a good time, because
it was Borstal back in the, so when I was young, that's what youth prison was called. Yeah, and it got less and less kind of tough sounding or seeming, Borstal, you know. And I remember wanting to make a movie that reflected that, and I thought, I'm interested in kind of the dynamic. Death Watch was an ensemble of men in a stressful situation. Kind of Wilderness was the same sort of vibe, but also wanting to make a kind of British feeling brutal slasher picture. And I thought it was an inconsequential movie, but it's weird that there's a certain group of young guys who grew up kind of like, I guess, the summer of 2006, 2007, when it was doing, you know, the movies and then on DVD, it really spoke to a bunch of guys. I'm like surprised that people, but that's not the movie that I put at the top of my list. You know, the order of movies that I think are good for me is different from what other people think, but you don't know. You put your material out there and hope it's okay.
Well, for me, it's just the nostalgic vibe about it. You know, British horror films and thrillers are sort of a once in a blue moon sort of thing. Every time you'll get a film like Wilderness, and then every once in a while you get like Censor by Prano Bailey Bond and Hush by Mark Tomurai, and they definitely stand out for either their brutality or their themes they're talking about. I saw Wilderness as a film that has a sort of political or social message behind it amidst all the violence. I will say, like you said, with the brutality of it, did you have any troubles with the BBFC?
I heard they gave
it an 18 at first, but then they re-rated it 15. Was that urban legend?
I'm just trying to think what the back and forth on that was. There were probably a few moments because, you know, he sets fire to a girl. I mean, it's the violence against women that was a problem, which obviously I was always very sensitive to, but it's a fact of life in a certain way. So you put two young women in the group of these violent young men, and there's a sort of love story in there as well. You know, and it was like, okay, how do you handle that sensitively? And like all things, we didn't really want it to be an 18 because that excludes a lot of audience. And we went, you know, you go through the process of with the BBFC was always, what's the, you know, if we do this, what's the rating? And I'll say, well, take 3-4 frames out of this. And but okay, is that all you want? Is it, where are your, what lines are we crossing? You know, there was no sexual violence. There was the implication of some violence, sexual violence, but it was never there because I don't really want to represent that particularly. But it was less, I remember on Death Watch, I got a rating because it was a pervasive sense. And they went, well, you can't take that out of the movie. It is what it is. But with Wilderness, there was moments where you go, okay, you've gone a little bit too far with a flesh ripping or this. And it's when violence becomes represented in a very real way that they get tricky with it. So, and also the sensibilities move. It's, you know, so what was a PG-13 or a 15 or an 18 back in the day, that all those move, everything moves as society moves. So I remember a bit of back and forth, but I don't think I ever had a big fight with anybody about rating. It's like, I felt like it was a 15. It felt like that's where it should land. And I was happy to make a few adjustments to incorporate that because it didn't take character out. And that's all you're ever trying to preserve ultimately is what's character story. So there's a thing that a character does that's important to narrative or to their development or to greater understanding. That's what you fight for. But if it's just an extra spurt of blood, and if you're spilling blood just for the sake of it, then you probably shouldn't be doing it at all.
No, then you should probably be making another version of Hostel, the source.
Sure. I mean, listen, Eli Roth got a very good career out of Hostel, so, you know.
That is true there, but I think Wilderness is a better film than those, and it's much better than Squid Game. Not that. If you might be working on season 2, but
no, don't worry. No, nobody's asked me about Squid Game. Okay, but I do think the social conversation is interesting for all horror movies. Is if you can find the thing that you're having the conversation about within the movie, and it doesn't have to be overt, but there's got to be a reason why the film exists. Otherwise, you're all making a lot of effort just to blow shit up or spill blood or whatever it's going to be. Not that that's not fun, by the way. They're empty calories. But at some point, you're going to say, well, what's... And I realize this, you know, when I do interviews, it's like people want to talk about what the film is about rather than just the experience of the movie. And I like that. I like to be able to have a wider conversation. And of course, who I was 15 years ago is very different from who I am now. My values have changed. Everything about my life has changed. So, you know, you sort of move on and develop.
That I'm aware of there. I know for some of the people who may be watching, they may be thinking, she called Michael Bassett, but just
for
sensitivity purposes, you'll always be known as MJ Bassett, but it is true.
And now, and of course you live a life, right?
Well, you know, to each their own, I suppose. We support the people of martial arts groups.
Community.
Oh, yes, sir, definitely. I myself am male, but I've got no problem with the transgender community. One of my friends...
I'm happy to hear it.
change.
I don't see why anybody has any problem with any of it. Nobody's hurting any. It's like, that's the thing. If you're hurting somebody, stop it. If you're not, then just go be you. All I know is that my journey involved me being very unhappy for a very long time and then really happy. And I'd rather be the really happy version of me than the miserable son of a bitch version of me that existed before. So, you know.
I would agree with you. I would do the same thing. Sometimes the experiences I had in 07 and 06, I don't want to relive. Even if, like some of the films back then. I know with some of the actors, like Lenore Critchlow and Adam Deacon, do you still talk with them to this day? Because Lenore Critchlow, I have a crush on her. She's a great actor.
Oh, really?
She was in Being Human and Black Mirror.
Yes, she was. Yeah. Well, Lee, I haven't spoken to for a long time. Toby, I haven't spoken to for a good few years. Adam, I speak to very regularly. I actually put Adam in one of my last, well, most recent movies, I think I did, called Rogue with Megan Fox, which was a action movie I shot in Africa a couple of years ago. And I brought Adam in just because, you know, I'd heard he had a few personal problems and I hadn't been in touch with him for a while. And I reached out and said, "Hey, honey, how you doing? You know, I hope life is good." And he said, "I'm struggling a little bit." And I went, "Hey, listen, I'm doing a movie in Africa. It's, you know, do you want to come play the bad guy?" Right? And he was like, "I'd love to. I'd love to get out of my own life for a little bit." And he came down and it was wonderful to see him again. He'd been through so much in terms of his mental health issues. You know, so he'd struggled a lot with, you know, some very publicized in terms of the his feud with Noel Clark and some mistakes he's made, which he's very very open and honest about, and the mental health issues which have come with that or caused his problems. And he came down to Africa and we spent time together, and it was lovely to see him again. But I'm trying to think who I mean Luke occasionally.
What about Andy Serkis, who everyone knows as Gollum, and he directed Andy too.
When I see them, I think with Andy, so in Death Watch, my first movie, I had Jamie Bell, Andy Serkis, Matthew Reese, Chris Marshall, a bunch of other guys. So it's a good ensemble. But obviously, Jamie and Andy went on to be big names. Matthew Reese is now doing incredibly well for himself as well. So Jamie, I saw a couple of years ago. Again, just come across them. And I live in LA now, so occasionally you'll go to a place and there will be somebody you know. Now, I haven't seen Andy for a couple of, since I came out as trans, right? So the part of my problem is that, like, I don't think these guys would recognize me anyway. But I saw Jamie, and I'd come out, and I was, you know, presenting female, and I went up to, and I was nervous about going up to him, right? Because, you know, he's made 20 movies. He did, like, I was a guy at the time who's just the second movie. He was Billy Elliot, big star, made Death Watch with him, and then he went off and lived his life. He was 15 when he made the movie with me, 15, 16, to turn 16 while we were doing it. Yeah, you know, he's been married. He's great. And he made a couple of, he made, you know, a couple of these little movies. Billy Elliot made him a star. I was the second one for him. He's now married with kids, right? He has a career. So I saw him in a bar at some party, some awards thing. I don't know what it was. And I was nervous. I was genuinely nervous. I said, "Look, I'm really sorry to bother you. I don't even remember me. I'm MJ Bassett. We made this movie Death Watch together." And he was like, he looked at me, he was like, "Holy shit." Right? But he was so lovely and gracious. And, you know, everyone says he's a lovely man. And that's my experience of him. Andy, I saw a few years ago before I came out. Again, got on very well. I know that he speaks fondly of doing Death Watch. And his, you know, he says it's the hardest movie he ever made physically.
Well, I can tell you, because that scene where the wires come out of his cheek.
Well, all of that. But it was just my first movie we shot in the Czech Republic in the middle of winter, which is a cold, cold place to be. And it was all exterior. There was no studio work. And I chose, because I'm, I don't know, masochist, to put rain onto the set every day. So we were raining every day. It was below freezing all the time. So the rain would freeze as it was coming down because it's these big water towers. And it would freeze on the actors. So between takes, they would be wet and their costumes would just freeze and they have to break the ice off their costumes as they would move. And it was, for all those guys, it was an incredibly serious physical challenge. I did the same thing to James Purefoy in when I made Solomon Kane, which is actually my favorite movie that I've made. I crucified James in the movie, right? So I put him on, and again, rained on the set. And again, it was Czech Republic, and again, it was middle of winter. But this time he was basically in a ripped shirt, so he couldn't even put a wetsuit on underneath to keep him warm. So yeah, I brutalized. Now, the one thing I will say is I will always stand with the actor in the rain and get wet too. I would never ask an actor to do something I wouldn't do myself, but yeah, it's pretty challenging.
Yeah,
I love it. I love doing that shit.
I would like to see how a scene like that would have appeared, because about Death Watch, I know I probably should have talked about this a bit more, but I think it's much better than 1917 or the Second World War film that Chris Nolan made called Dunkirk. Everyone talks about those two particular...
Well, that's very kind.
I'm sure...
Well, they're very different. Death Watch grew out of a couple of things for me. One is I'd written a bunch of movies which nobody wanted to make, as you know, struggling filmmaker in the UK. And I was always a horror fan, obviously, growing up on that kind of the video nasty generation. But it was, what movie can I make which will be achievable? So you kind of put your producer head on a little bit. And it was like, okay, The Trenches of World War One, which I was very obsessed with anyway, because my grandfather had some books of photographs from the trenches, which I looked at as a little kid, and they'd really sort of burned themselves in my mind. I thought, okay, I can do an ensemble horror in the trenches. It can be about the kind of literal horror of war, and you know, be an ensemble and be about heroism and be about cruelty and all the things which go along with any kind of when you put men into combat. So that was the impetus behind it, and to try and make it feel grim and real, because it just, the trenches were fucking horrible, right? It was forget the bullets whizzing past, just the experience of being there. And that's what I wanted.
Since the dead bodies and blood.
Oh, the dead relentlessness of just PTSD being surrounded by death.
Shell shock.
Yeah, totally. So I wanted to try and capture that. And all the characters in Death Watch are named after guys who got VCs at the Somme. They all, except for Charlie Shakespeare, except for Jamie's character, who I called Charlie Shakespeare because I wanted you to remember his name. But everybody else is named after, you know, heroes of the Somme. And some of the characteristics of them, like, Chris Marshall's character wears chainmail because there was a soldier who wore chainmail. Andy Serkis' character wears a wolfskin because there was a soldier who wore wolfskin. He also is a soldier who collects the scalps of German officers, which is a true thing. So I just tried to sort of mix in all these horrors. And I love the movie. And actually, I was talking to the producer, because he's 20 years old now. I was talking to the producer of it and said, I have an idea for a sequel. So... there's something I want to do with that idea. If Jamie's up for it, I might one day approach them and say, well, I do have an idea for how we can look at the legacy of the horror of war. Anyway,
that would be a very powerful tool indeed, especially with the fall of Afghanistan lately. Discussions about wartime violence and post-traumatic stress. It could definitely be used as a sort of talking tool for veterans who have suffered great scenes of violence and terror in their lives, and if you put in a modern sort of context about Iraq or Afghanistan or even Gulf Second War, it might be a very interesting thing.
Well, my take on this is that I don't think anybody really wants to see movies about those specific things, right? So if you try and take you got to put it into a fantastical context, because again and again.
It's too
close. You need some distance. So if you, and the joy of the genres, particularly horror, is that you can tell any story you want, wrap it up in something else. I mean, all the great, you know, like the movies that grew out of the 70s, Wes Craven stuff and junk, they're about the counterculture, right? And that's what you can have the conversations about. And the same with, I've really just written a low budget little movie, an ensemble, which is about PTSD and dealing with stress, because I've worked with a lot of soldiers now, because I used to make a show called Strike Back, which is a big action show, which is about soldiers. And I ended up training with lots of soldiers and working with them and just talking to them about how do you reintegrate into civilian life after having essentially been done things which nobody's done. It's the warrior class is, and particularly in America, right? There's so many soldiers and so many, they're just, how do you live back in society? So I'm always interested in those kinds of ideas.
I think what you're doing is a great service for the people who I've seen certainly a lot there, whether you are left wing or right wing. It is a problem that needs to be solved, especially.
Yeah, I'm not interested in the politics. Yeah, politics is too polarizing, but the human experience is really the thing that matters.
Oh, definitely. I will say about the horror thing, not to cut you off. My favorite ones to tend to be films that touch on social issues or some sort of topic, like Videodrome, for instance. That was a product of its time. You had all the video nasties and hardline violence and pornography that was available to the masses, and how it could desensitize people and corrupt their mind. Those are my favorite ones, the ones that sort of touch on something. I don't know if
But can you imagine what Videodrome would be? Yeah, but can you imagine what Videodrome would be like now with social media and the kind of the tentacles of the internet everywhere, right? So that would be, I think that's a movie that should be revisited. I don't know which filmmaker is the right filmmaker for it, but the underlying themes and ideas of what Videodrome was talking about now would be extraordinary with Cronenberg's kind of body horror techniques and sensibilities. I mean, maybe Cronenberg should do it. Maybe he might be a little old. He seems less interested in that stuff now. But somebody, the right filmmaker plugged into that material to explore the ideas would be amazing.
Cool Prano. She's one of my friends. She's from Wales. See if she's interested, but she's done a film that's very similar to that. So I don't know if she might be taken up on the task.
Well, I know who holds the rights to Videodrome, so maybe...
maybe his son, Brandon, who done Possessor, and may be interested.
Yeah.
Like father, like son, Jason Reitman took his father's project of Ghostbusters, this afterlife spin-off or something.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, legacy filmmaking seems to be an in thing at the moment.
Oh, yes, so definitely. And I'll also say about your transition from the UK to Hollywood. I'm sure people are wondering about that, thinking, oh, is it because of Brexit? There's probably a little bit more to it than that, because the British film industry is a bit in tatters. A lot of government
finance. Oh, it was nothing to do with Brexit. It was everything to do with me coming out and then wanting to just kind of reinvent my life and live a different way. And I mean, I'm English. I love England. I love the heritage and the history and the mythology and the folklore of England. I'm obsessed with it. But it just felt like it was time. You know, my kids grew up and they'd left home, and I could be who I really wanted to be. And I thought, let's go and live on the beach in LA for a while. I never say I live in Hollywood. I don't. I very rarely go to Hollywood. But so I live in the mountains outside of Los Angeles now. And it's a good life. I like the sunshine. You know, I like being in the sun in the middle of winter. But also, I shoot internationally, right? So I make very few things, even in LA, like just the occasional TV show. If I'm making a movie, I spend most of my time, I've been to Thailand, I've been to New Zealand, I've been to Africa, I've been to a bunch of countries in Africa, I've been to Canada, all over Europe. I mean, like those, as a filmmaker, that's where you go, because you're chasing, from a producing point of view, just chasing cheap places to film. You're chasing the tax rebates, you're chasing that side of things, looking for somewhere that's got a good crew that gives you a good tax rebate, allows you to make a movie. I mean, but I personally, because my background was, I originally started as a wildlife filmmaker and photographer. So my great passion in life is natural history and conservation. So getting to Africa and shooting in Kenya or South Africa or Mozambique or wherever, or Botswana, these are the incredible places to go. So I'm always looking for excuses to go there.
Well, I'm very impressed by the many countries and continents that you have been. I know a lot of films right now being produced over in by the Department of Trade and Industry for South Africa. And then also in the US, you've got Georgia and I think Arizona and Pennsylvania. They're giving tax rebates to filmmakers. A lot of movie productions set like in Atlanta. And then obviously of Vancouver and Toronto, which is
everybody goes up there. I spent a lot of time in Vancouver.
I would certainly like to work up there myself for film and TV purposes. I'm also a French speaker, so in case if they film up in Montreal or Ottawa, then you got me.
All right.
So, very interesting right there. I mean, Britain, you know, even for all of its problems, more and more of the productions are being set in Cymru. Sorry, I spoke Welsh. Wales.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little cheaper and there's more sort of opportunities. Like from what I hear of Doctor Who and Da Vinci's Demons being filmed up in Canada and Pembroke and Canada and So yes, we wish the best of luck to those filmmakers out there as well. And
I mean, well, again, the thing is, it's all about tax rebates. So for Wales, the government, a lot of money from Europe came in, which obviously doesn't exist now because, you know, the whole Brexit thing. But the studios that were set up there, and I've worked in a couple of those studios, and there's Dragon Studios and there's Bad Wolf and there's a few others around Cardiff. You know, the crews are great, it's a lovely place to work. So I went down there for this thing called Da Vinci's Demons, which was lots of fun to make. And I have family in Cardiff now as well. But yeah, it's the UK gives a good rebate, but it's worth a lot if you have a big expensive movie, like, you know, the Star Wars movies or whatever it's going to be. The like little James movies. Bond. Yeah, the giant studios. And also the streamers, like the Netflixes of the world and the Apples, they're taking up all the studio space. So I live in the smaller indie world, and it's a little bit harder to find space to exist there. And you also want to make a TV show, which is fully financed. I've done a thing with Chris Pratt, and I've just done Jack Reacher stuff. Those are biggish shows, and they find their space in the world because the studios have the muscle to, you know, buy up their place. When I'm making one of my little indie movies, I got to be smart about how I'm doing it. So it's all about navigating the business. And indie movie finance is still a pain. You know, 20 years on, it's still a pain in the ass. I'm not a big name filmmaker. I don't command lots of budgets, but I have my own ecosystem I work with, and I'm really happy to be there.
Because most of the people I've met, they obviously have never heard many of your films, except for Silent Hill Revelation, because it's connected to
the one I like the least. There we go.
But, you know, that's open to people's debate there. And I know you worked on a lot of TV shows and got to meet quite a few connections. How was it like working with Wesley Snipes after his old tax issues he's been having?
And
Bruce Campbell.
Well, yeah, it was fine. Wesley was okay. Wesley had his own problems because he'd just not long been out of jail and was adjusting back to, it was the first TV thing he'd done as well. So he wasn't quite used to the pace of TV. So Wesley was Wesley, that's all I'll say about that. Bruce was fun. Again, the thing about doing Ash versus Evil Dead is that I grew up on Evil Dead, right? So Sam Raimi and his gang of young filmmakers, you know, Rob Tappert and Bruce and Sam together, just going in and making this movie in the woods and changing the landscape of indie filmmaking was hugely important. And 20 years later, to be invited to go down, we shot it in New Zealand, to go to New Zealand, and I took over the show from Sam. So Sam shot the pilot, it was his thing, right? So, and I was the first filmmaker to do anything Evil Dead that wasn't Sam. And I remember sitting down with Bruce Campbell, who obviously is iconic to me, right? And he, you know, he's like, well, he said, I've never done this character with any other filmmaker. And again, this was pre my transition as well. So like a, you know, dude sitting down with him, and he would, you know, he said, like, I like to do it this way. I have these things. And I'm like, okay, we'll try. And I had to find a way of being Sam Raimi and that style and still make it my own, which is fun. And Bruce knows precisely what he's doing. So it's funny. Like, so we do a thing, we rehearse it, and he can make anything funny. And not like slap, but just entertaining. He can move in a certain way or do a look or just hold a prop in a particular way. And occasionally you'd be like, hey, that was great, Bruce. Why don't we do it again this way? And you're like, yeah. And then you do the second take, but it will be exactly the same as the first take because he knows what he wants to do. Right. So you work around Bruce, you know, he's thought about it, and you watch him offset sometimes. He'll just be planning something in his head. He's thought it through. He's very meticulous. He's hugely entertaining. But at the same time, he's, you know, he's a serious man about his business. So it was fun to do that. I did a bunch of those, and I ended up writing some. I was a producer on the show as well. So that was a really, really fun experience. I loved it.
My friend loves Ash versus Evil Dead and the franchise itself. And even like the remake that they did by Fede Alvarez.
Fede's good, yeah.
We always talk about Sam Raimi particularly because I myself am a fan of Darkman, which is a superhero film that no one ever seems to talk about. But I have a sort of personal love for it because it's very similar to Deadpool and Spawn and The Mask. These sort of type of superheroes that not really for children. They're 15 or 18 to forget, but there's a charm about them that you don't see in other works. And then the Spider-Man movies that he did, those are my personal favorites more so than Andrew Garfield and Tom Holland.
Right.
Not Superman, Spider-Man.
Yeah. Okay, so well, also, they speak to you at a certain time, right? So because for the longest time with Spider-Man, you know, James Cameron was going to do it, right? So there was this famous, what's called a scriptment, which was this very, very long detailed outline of how James Cameron was going to do Spider-Man. And they never went into production, never cracked it. And when Sam finally did Spider-Man really well, Tobey Maguire was good casting. It was a great movie. The second Spider-Man movie is a fantastic film, you know? And then it becomes a law of diminishing returns. And then Marvel came along and reinvented superhero movies. And I think Tom Holland is just brilliant casting for Spider-Man. I love the last one that just came out with the three of them together. Sorry, spoiler alert for those who haven't seen it. It's just absolutely fantastic. But yeah, I mean, Sam is a really good filmmaker. He has his style, and it's a unique style. I can't wait to see what he does with Doctor Strange.
With sort of over-the-top levels of violence and the humor about it, it's very electric of its own beast. Harry did his work in the movie Evil Ed, which is a Swedish horror film that they made in English, of a censor who goes mad by kind of all this violence. He turns into a beast from within. And it turns out to be something that resembles Bruce Campbell's character from Evil Dead 2.
Just all right.
Seven-hand doing the fucking...
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's a generation of us who are absolutely in awe of what Sam did, and that sort of such a unique style as well. And he, to this day, he still does that, you know, like he's also, you know, a very good serious filmmaker when he decides to do something like A Simple Plan, which I really, really like, you know, this kind of cold crime story with, you know, Billy Bob Thornton, Bill Paxton. And
he also did Crime Wave with the Coens. Thing.
Yeah, well, they were always the editors for him. Yeah, yeah. A Crime Wave I like less, but I see what they were trying to do. It was a troubled movie by the sounds of it.
Mm-hmm. I suppose so. Have you or Raimi ever met Peter Jackson? Because Peter Jackson's like the Kiwi Sam Raimi. Brain dead,
the
feebles. Oh, my goodness.
Peter Jackson very briefly at Comic-Con several years ago. I met Peter Jackson and James Cameron at the same time, which was very intimidating. I think I can't remember whether it was for Solomon Kane or for Silent Hill, but I was in the green room waiting to go into Hall H, which is the big hall, to present my little movie. And I was wedged between a Peter Jackson presentation and a James Cameron presentation. And he was like, what the hell am I doing here? It was the weirdest thing to be.
That sounds brilliant.
It isn't. It's like when you don't belong somewhere. You know, you have these gargantuan talents who change the face of storytelling and filmmaking, and then me. And it's like, okay, it's great, but really, I don't belong here. So,
yeah, I get what you mean, because not many people have heard of MJ Bassett, but they certainly should with your impressive resume or CV of work that you have in your pedestal. And I know you're kind of pressed for time, so I'll just give you one or two more questions.
Okay.
Adelaide Clemens.
Mm-hmm.
Have ever people get her confused with Michelle Williams?
Yes, because they look really, really similar.
And you filmed this in Australia or New Zealand, so I'm sure they're probably thinking, hey,
No. I filmed Silent Hill in Toronto.
Oh, it was Canadian? Oh.
Yeah.
This woman was Australian for some reason. I think she's from...
Yeah, she is Australian, but yeah.
Okay. I'll tell that to my friend. He's a big fan of the video games. That one ad for Silent Hill 3 terrified me when I was a child. And then when you were saying about Spider-Man earlier on, that was the first film that I saw that was a 12A. You remember when that first came out, 12A?
Hmm.
Yeah. That's why it stands by me. So the Raimi connection, I definitely caught my eye there. And then your favorite sci-fi or thriller films. I know those are the two genres and horror that you are a great fan of. Hello? Hello? Hello, can you hear me? So sorry about that. I really don't know what happened.
That's all right, honey.
Internet glitch or something.
It's the modern world, darling. That's what happens. The all I say is, look, our signal is being bounced into space. It lucky it comes down at all. Yeah, exactly.
Especially with the
exactly, exactly.
5G, all these weird signals.
Or who knows what's going on? They're all getting our brains microwaved. Do you want to ask that Adelaide Clemens question again so we can pick it up?
Oh, yes. Try to put glue together. Now, Adelaide Clemens, people on set or anyone who's met you say, why does she look like Michelle Williams?
She does look like Michelle Williams. And they're both Australian, so there's clearly some genetic heritage there. But yeah, Adelaide auditioned, again, she's just, you know, one of the actresses who came to the audition, and I really liked her, and she's gone on to do some interesting stuff. She's a very gentle presence. I remember Silent Hill, and it wasn't the happiest experience of me for making the movie. I made it in 3D, which I didn't want to do, and I'm well on record as saying how unhappy I am with the finished film. For, you know, most of those reasons are my fault. Even though I was a fan of the game, I took a swing and missed. And there are those who like it, and thank you for liking it, but there's many more who don't. But with Adelaide, she had to fire a gun at one point, and she'd never fired a weapon before. And, you know, obviously she's firing blanks, it's not a real gun at all, but she was very distressed by the whole thing. She fired the gun, did the take, and then went off and cried. It's just not in her nature to be that person. So, it's fun. I noticed I had Kit Harington in Silent Hill before Kit had done Game of Thrones. So he auditioned after he'd finished the first season of Game of Thrones, which hadn't come out. So he was telling me about this. And I'm like, oh, that sounds like a bunch of fun. I love that. I love fantasy stuff. I'd love to have done a show. I said, who do you play? He said, oh, I play the bastard son of, you know, the lead character. I went, oh, you'll end up as the king then, right? He went, what? I said, oh, no, the bastard son is always the king at the end of the story. That's why there's a bastard. He went, no, I'm going to get killed off. I said, no, trust me. You'll be there till the end. I took Kit to Comic-Con to promote, I think it was a Silent Hill promotion before anybody knew who he was. And it was like just Kit. And then I went with him again a couple of years later after the couple of seasons. He couldn't move. I mean, like, he was mobbed. It was just the development of somebody's celebrity. And I know he struggled to deal with it because he was a very nice young man. Just that the imposition of that amount of fame so suddenly is really challenging for people.
Yeah, I could imagine that. Like, I'm sure for Bryan Cranston, before he did Breaking Bad, he was just kind of like, you know, here and there in films and TV. But
No. Hell, I know. Bryan Cranston was Malcolm in the Middle. He was the dad in Malcolm in the Middle, which is a big show. So that was the bigger thing for him, was that he was already really well known from Malcolm in the Middle, and Breaking Bad wasn't a big hit for a long time. That was a thing, and it only became a big hit because of streaming, because people could binge the show. Yeah, it was Netflix that made Breaking Bad. You know, I remember doing
I thought it was AMC or Sony Pictures.
Yeah, it's their show, but it was. It didn't get a big traction until it was available for streaming, and then it found its audience. And then suddenly, and also the first season of Breaking Bad is a little bit wonky in its tonal approach. And I met Vince Gilligan a couple of times. He's a fantastically clever man. And the journey he took, you know, Walter White on, is just one of the greatest in television. It's fantastic.
Well, I'll definitely give him my kind regards. All my friends love Breaking Bad.
For sure.
I'm a bit more of a Mad Men fan.
If you're talking about, really? I like Mad Men too.
Have you watched
Better Call Saul?
I've seen a few episodes of it. I actually like it more than
Breaking Bad. It's really, really good.
So I like dark comedy. You know, yeah. I like that sort of twisted Christmas type of humor.
Nice. It's really, really, really good. And I actually think it might be... When they're both finally played side by side and they're finished, because I know this is the final season of Better Call Saul. I think it might be a better show, but we'll see how they play it all off.
We'll see there. For me, TV wise, I know I'm kind of going on here and there, but I've mostly just been watching like travel shows, and I really do like the Spitting Image revival show that they did for BritBox.
I haven't seen that, I'm afraid. I remember the original Spitting Image. I had friends who worked on it. Right? And, the new one I haven't seen. I don't watch a lot of UK TV these days. So.
Well, to each his own, I suppose. And then also No Sudden Move or No Second Chance. It's a French program that I've been watching to help improve my language skills. It's kind of like Lupin, but about the mysterious vibes about it.
Right.
To each his own, I suppose. And
absolutely. But, I mean, it depends how much time you have as well. Binge watching these days is, is the way to get the pandemic to leave us all alone.
Exactly. But it's the new drug, and you've got to be careful. It's just like drink driving or drugs or pornography. You have to limit your consumption.
Says you.
Well, what can I say? But
exactly.
The last question here will be about your favorite sci-fi, thriller or horror film, because I know those are the genres that you've worked with.
Oh, well, my favorite sci-fi is Blade Runner, just because
Men in Black.
Fair enough. So Blade Runner, because I think it's one of my favorite movies of all time, because it's about something. It's about the search for humanity and the very essence of what we are. I mean, when you watch it now, it's a very slow, ponderous movie, and I even like the sequel as well. Favorite thriller? Oh my lord!
You can say Death Watch or Wilderness.
Well, because they're not. Well, they wouldn't be. My favorite horror movie is The Thing, John Carpenter's remake of The Thing. I think that's one of the best horror movies ever made. Again, because it's a small group of people surviving, but the ramifications and the resonance of that is very strong. Just incredible effects. I remember just being completely blown away. Love American Werewolf in London. Obviously, I'm aging myself because those are films I grew up with. I think my favorite recent horror is It Follows, which I think is absolutely fantastic.
Wait, what title?
It's called It Follows.
Oh, yes. It's got Micah Monroe.
Yeah.
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 My really film.
Yeah, I think it's a beautifully made movie. It's one of those movies you watch and you just kind of go, oh shit, I don't know how to direct. That person knows how to direct. Right, the surety of how it was put together. Thriller wise, I don't know. There's so many. I mean, like, what is? You mean a running, jumping, chase, and action movie? Because Terminator 2 is a thriller in that basis, right?
Yeah, it's an action picture category. I mean, I include Get Out as a thriller, also than a horror, because of its realistic and
subject. But this is where genre blurring and genre bending is a fun thing to do. So I don't know. I can't, off the top of my head, I can't think of that one.
Well, to each his own, I suppose. My favorite horror film, I know I consider Wilderness a thriller, but I would say it's Coraline. That's my favorite horror film.
I don't know that. I think Neil might argue that it's not pure horror, but there we go.
It's animated and it's PG, but there are scenes which parents felt was too scary and intense for young children.
I remember taking my little kids to it. I remember taking them to it. It's quite an intense thing. Nightmare Before Christmas, again, on that basis, might be a horror movie. But I like that. It's clever how you can, the notion that you have to be an R-rated or an 18-rated movie to be horror, clearly that's not true. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang has one of the most famous horrific sequences of all time. The child catcher sequence. Every kid of a certain age, that's horrific. It's a nightmare sequence.
My father is 58 years old. He's going to turn 58 soon. And he found that scene terrifying. That was one of the first films he saw as a little in at the cinema alongside Mary Poppins.
That's what it is. It's about context. It's about context. It's about how it affects you personally. And some things people are affected by, which you wouldn't even begin to imagine. That's a thing for them.
Because when I saw like Wilderness and Death Watch around that same time at the cinema, you had a lot of sort of disturbing ads for road safety or safe sex or domestic violence. And I found those ads from Fink. You remember that, the Department for Transport?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's also nightmares for me.
Totally. I remember one when I was young. I'm a lot younger than you, a lot older than you. There was a big campaign to stop rabies, the disease, getting from Europe to the UK. And the posters and the advertising campaign scared the shit out of me. as a little kid. Just all those health, and there were all these kind of public health and safety, and there are animations and things which are weird and creepy.
No, even that. I think there was one ad that was animated that was unsettling. That had a pen that turned into a snake, and it was for dyslexia. And then
right,
anime ad from NSPCC warning about, children beating their kids, and it had a scene with
horrible.
Beating this child.
It's all about what gets you at a certain time. But there we go. As you say, it's each to their own.
I think you should make a PSA or public information film of your own for drink driving. You would terrify me.
It would be very scary.
And show a man with a barbed wire going through his cheek as he realizes when you kill someone while you're driving more than 70 miles per hour.
Well, I think it sounds like you've got a plan for it already. You should do it.
I do indeed, there. I certainly do. And I would certainly like to thank you for your time on this interview. I'm going to press off record.
All right, you're very welcome.
I'm MJ Bassett. And we'll hopefully talk more next time about your future film and TV projects.
All right, nice to talk to you. Take care of yourself.